Hello and welcome to episode 202 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other assignments. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm doing great, Seth.
Well, today we are going to do things a bit different. Since a great many of the episodes this season will feature stories of the silent service and the submarine force by nature was rather clandestine during World War II, we figured that while our astute listeners probably know a good bit about subs in the Pacific, certainly about some of the personalities like Mush Morton, Dick O'Kane, people like that, we would be willing to bet that a great majority of you people don't actually understand all what went into operating a submarine in the Pacific in the war against Japan. So to that end, we're going to give you, the listener, a lesson, a sort of, quote, how to submarine, unquote, or submarines 101. And I ain't giving you the lesson. So who better to give you the lesson than our very own subskipper, Captain Bill Todi? Bill, we all know that this is a topic for obvious reasons that is near and dear to your heart. And submarines weren't just like you see in the movie where you just pull up to the ship and fire a couple of torpedoes and ship goes down and everything happens and, you know, yay, flags waving, is it?
No, it isn't, Seth. And I really do welcome the opportunity to have this chat. One of the things that really surprised me when I was a very young officer, I was still an ensign when I reported to my first Los Angeles class submarine, was despite the fact that we were a modern nuclear submarine, so many of the things we still did in the early 1980s were pretty much identical to the way submarines operated in World War II. We leveraged a lot of the lessons learned from submarine operations in World War II, and we really did try to keep that mindset. My first and pretty much only home port during my submarine duties were Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And the officers, the BOQ, Bachelor Officer Quarter, name was Lockwood Hall. Lockwood Hall had a bar in it called the Clean Sweep Bar.
Nice.
And the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, you might call it, inside Lockwood Hall was the Skipper's Lounge. And in the Skipper's Lounge were the photographs of the seven Medal of Honor recipient submarine COs and the dozens, I think maybe 40-ish, Navy Cross recipient submariners from World War II. Those photos were emblazoned on the wall, and we would go in there and have these guys staring down at us as we did random training. Now, a bit of a segue here. This is kind of a silly story. But when alcohol went out of fashion in the Navy in the 90s, the Clean Sweep Bar was shut down, if you can believe that. And it had mementos all over it from World War II submarines. And there was a padlock put on it. So when I was captain of a submarine, my junior officers didn't have the experience of sitting in those places and experiencing that heritage. And we were going to be called on to do a very stressing mission. And I was worried that I needed to get my officer's mind right. And this became one of those easier to get forgiveness than permission things. One day I went to the local hardware store. I bought a bolt cutter and I went to the Clean Sweep Bar and I try to do it legitimately first. I don't want to lead you to believe that I jumped to this step after. I tried to get the key. I tried to get permission. I tried everything. And it was so enmeshed in bureaucracy because all BOQs became big Navy BOQs. Not the submarine base wasn't a submarine base anymore. It was a naval station, Pearl Harbor. In fact, it was Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam, even worse. And so... the bureaucracy was so screwed up. We only had a few weeks before we were going to leave on deployment. I did go to a hardware store, got these bolt cutters, cut the lock off of the Clean Sweep Bar, and brought my officers in there. and we did training in there, surrounded by those mementos and those heroes. Jumping ahead, we deployed. We had a very, very successful deployment, received the first Navy unit commendation that ship had ever received. We received the Battle E and a whole bunch of other awards. And after it was done, the commander of Submarine Force Pacific, Admiral, asked me, "Bill, what did you do to prepare for this deployment that you think made it so successful? And I shared with him, I guess I felt a little bulletproof at this point after our successful deployment. I shared with him my story of cutting off the bolt, the lock on Clean Sweep Bar, going in there and talking story, to use the Hawaiian expression, talking story about the World War II submariners, their missions, their challenges that they had to overcome, and let that seep in and inspire my officers. And I thought, wasn't sure if I was going to get court-martialed or patted on the back. It turns out I got patted on the back, and they decided to institutionalize. They took the lock off permanently, and they decided to have weekly sessions in that. So they brought it back just like it was when I was a junior officer. Long-winded introduction, isn't it, Seth?
No, but it's important. It's important because, you know, you guys, you stood on the shoulders of giants. I mean, you did. Absolutely. Legends, you know, Morton, O'Kane, Street, you know, boats like Wahoo, Tang, Tarante, Silversides, you know, I mean, could go on and on and on and on and on and on.
And except for Morton, I met most of those guys during my submarine tour at Beach. I mean, go down the list, the guys who are still living in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, I got to meet every one of them, as did every other submarine CO of my generation.
That's fantastic. And I'm envious because, you know, I got to, as you and the listeners know, I knew a lot of warriors in the Pacific, only guys who rode submarines, never guys who skippered any of them. But
yeah. Well, now, by the way, for listeners, I've been teasing Seth with all of my books, Clear the Bridge, dated 1978, signed by Richard O'Kane.
Personal hero.
Silent Victory, signed by Medal of Honor recipient George Street. I have Gene Flucky's Thunder Below, signed by Gene Flucky, in it, one of my most prized possessions, because in it he calls me a great submariner.
That's awesome.
I hope to during my submarine career, I hope to have lived up to that very nice accolade by Gene Flucky. But what we intended to do here today wasn't going to be a complete submarine 101.
Right.
We're not going to talk to you about how we shower. We're not going to talk to you about how we blow the ballast tanks after we surface.
Right.
We're going to talk to you about how to conduct a torpedo attack. So it's basically torpedo attack 101 that would have pertained to any one of the stories we're going to tell you about submarine attacks in World War II during this season.
Well, so before the war, you know, submarines, you said this numerous times, and it's a pretty well-known fact that submarines were the smallest percentage of the U.S. Navy. It was, you know, as you said before, there were more dentists than there were submariners. And
submarine officers, right, yeah.
Submarine officers, yeah. And you look at it, and before the war, and certainly during the war too, there were a lot of accidents. So life in the submarine was not, you know, Operation Pacific with John Wayne. It was significantly more dangerous, even when you weren't being depth charged to death by Japanese destroyers. There were a lot of accidents in submarines, both before and during the war, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. And as a result of those accidents, in fact, Admiral King was personally in charge of two submarine rescue and sadly recovery operations when he was Captain King. After he graduated from submarine school. And I said this before, he never did the work to earn his dolphins. Mm. He never went through submarine qualification, but he did go through submarine school. But what that environment did is it really rewarded conservatism among the skippers, because conservative skippers in peacetime didn't have accidents and they didn't die along with their crews, because that's the other aspect of submarine operations that's different than surface or carrier operations, is that when a submarine goes down, generally 100% of the crew is lost.
Right.
Whereas when a surface ship goes down, often two thirds, three quarters of the crew survives.
Right.
So it was a real travesty. You not only lost the boat, but you lost 60, 70, 80, depending on the class of boat, of crew members who now needed to be replaced in future submarine operations. Mm-hmm. And that was a bad thing. Now, so conservatism in peacetime was rewarded. But as soon as we went to war, that same kind of conservatism led to failure in combat.
Consistent failure, too.
Absolutely. So the skippers who really did well and were thought highly of before the war, most of them had to be replaced once the war started. And as a result, the average age of submarine COs went from 40 years old before the war to about 30 years old during the war. Now, I was in command when I was 40. Nuclear boats are different than those fast attack, than those diesel boats during the war. And so younger COs, there would be guys that had 4, 5, 6 years of submarine experience that became COs. I think I served 6, 7, 8 years as a department head in submarines before I became XO. And so, you know, those are the things that happen during war, because you're going to have to, you know, take a different kind of mindset to be successful.
And when you look at the, and we're not going to get into all the submarine skippers now, we will, but we're, well, not all of them, but we'll get into a lot of the famous ones throughout this upcoming season. But when you look at these guys, you know, of course, you know, there's several names that rise to the top, but to your point, they were all, I wouldn't say young men, but they were younger men and you know, in their 30s, like you were saying. And these guys were pirates, man. I mean, they did stuff that, like, these earlier skippers, these pre-war skippers, and not to say that they weren't pre-war skippers that were successful, because there were. However, the ones that were staring over your shoulder in the clean, sweet bar, most of those guys, I would venture to guess, got their first command in 1943 or 44 or even 45.
Absolutely.
And these cats were learning from the early trailblazers, like one of my personal heroes, Dudley W. Morton, you know, Mush Morton, Richard O'Kane, Slade Cutter, guys like that, who just took the rule book, tore it up, used it for TP, and said, we're going to write our own rules. And that's just, that's huge, because that's the kind of operation, that's the kind of leadership that the subforce, especially with our bad torpedoes, and I know we're going to get to that, needed in 1943, after a lot of failures in late 41 and all the way through 42.
You know, as Admiral Fargo said in episode 201, a lot of the most successful submarine COs were football players at Annapolis.
True. Now,
I was as far away from a football player as you could get at Annapolis. But, you know, that's true. Back in those days, it was the devil may care attitude that created a successful submarine CO.
Yeah.
We tried to give every new commanding officer a patrol as prospective commanding officer before they took command of the submarine. And the general rule of thumb was you would not do a patrol on the boat you were going to take command of, because you're still learning. If you screw something up while you're the prospective commanding officer, you'll hear me refer to it as PCO. They don't want the crew to think badly of you.
Right.
So that if you're going to screw
Makes
up, they
sense.
Want you to screw up, on somebody else's boat. The one exception that I know of was the guy you mentioned, Dudley Mush Morton, who rode Wahoo as PCO, and Richard O'Kane, his XO, the XO, it wasn't his XO yet, but the XO of Wahoo, thought so highly of Morton and so poorly of the sitting CO, that after they returned from that to patrol where Morton rode as PCO, O'Kane went to the admiral and said, in fact, it was still Admiral Lockwood in Australia at the time, said, look, this CO is not working out. Morton is ready now. Why don't you give the boat to him? He's going to be captain of some submarine. Why not this one?
Might as well be this one.
Crew loved him. So Morton was the exception to the rule.
Right.
He did a PCO patrol on Wahoo and then took command of it. But generally, that didn't happen. Now, the sad thing is some historians have mistakenly referred to that experience where you've got a PCO and a CO on the same boat as having two captains. That is not the case. Right. Make no mistake, there is only one captain at any time on any submarine. So right. If you've read something like that in some history about Morton being the second captain on Wahoo, that was not the case. Yeah. He was still in training when that when he rowed.
That's a common saying too, you know, a ship can only have one captain. Right. The same goes even when you have a perspective commanding officer. Like you said, it's not a command, or theoretically not a commanding officer of that boat. But you know, some of these guys that we're going to talk about, you know, Cutter and people like that, they I don't want to say revolutionized tactics for submarines, but they invented a lot of the tactics for submarines. One of the things that was unheard of before the war, and even in the beginning of the war, was a submarine running on the surface. The only time that sucker ran on the surface was getting into Pearl Harbor and getting out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they damn sure didn't run on the surface going to, you know, I don't know, the China Sea or whatever it is. And they for sure didn't make surface attacks, you know, unless, you know, they were about to die for whatever reason. But guys like these newfangled skippers, as the kids would say, you know, these new these newer skippers that are coming into the silent service, they did this, you know, and this was a tactic that they pushed through the rest of the war, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the decades after the World War II, when people started surmising that, oh, the United States could benefit from some diesel submarines, because diesels, when they're on the battery, can be very, very quiet. We had to point, we nuclear submariners had to point out to these people, who most of whom never rode a submarine in their life, that submarines submerged, diesel submarines submerged, are essentially smart mines because they're pretty stationary. They can't go anywhere. Now, that's fine if you're going to defend your shoreline, but it's not fine if you intend to fight on the other side of a large ocean like the Pacific. Now, in World War II, there was no option to have nuclear submarines. So they would transit at high speed on the surface. But when they got to the patrol area, they would be submerged daytime, like 100% of the time, regardless of whether there was a target there or not, or a threat there or not. Once they submerged, they really couldn't move 2-3 knots if they wanted to stretch their battery, right? So that's basically why we say it's a smart mine. They can make things blow up, but that thing that they're going to blow up has to come to them.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the speed to go to the thing that they want to blow up. That's a mine. When you have to run over something for it to blow up, that's a mine. So you get why we say that a submerged diesel boat is no better than a smart mine.
Yeah.
Skippers figured this out over time and realized, if nobody's going to run unless I'm in a choke point,
right?
And that enemy has to get through the choke point. And by the way, do you really want to be in a choke point if you're in a submarine? Because you're also easy to target if you're in the choke point. You need to be able to maneuver at high speed if you're going to catch up with any surface running surface ship target. So the guys figured out, they sussed it out, that they need to be on the surface anytime they're not really threatened. So they developed this doctrine where, okay, we're going to stay on the surface at all time, especially when they got air search radar. Because the airplanes were the biggest threat when they were on the surface, because the airplane can come at them really fast.
Right.
And if they couldn't submerge quickly, they were going to be in trouble. So they developed this doctrine where they would run on the surface, and then they would practice submerging drills over and over and over again until they had it rote memory. 45 seconds. First, the bridge, the officer deck yells, "Lookouts below." So the lookouts would jump down from the cigarette bridge. You know why they called it a cigarette bridge? It was because that's where people would go to smoke. But it was higher than the normal bridge, so it gave you better height of eye and better for the lookouts. So lookouts below, they would jump down from the cigarette bridge. They would jump down the scuttle into the conning tower. The OD, as soon as they were down, would yell, "Clear the bridge." Then the OD and everyone else that was on the bridge would jump down into the conning tower. Obviously, in parallel with this, he's already ordered shift propulsion to the battery. Then if he's crash dives, he's the officer of the deck is the last man down from the bridge. He pulls the hatch shut with him. Somebody's hanging on the lanyard of the bridge hatch as he's dogging the bridge hatch really quick. He jumps down, yells, "Last man down, hatch secured." That's once the diving off of the watch hears that order, he knows he can get down. The chief of the watch, who's on the ballast control panel, has these indicators called the Christmas tree because there were red and light, red and green lights. Red was bad, green was good. Well, he yells straight board. What straight board means is that green. All of the external hull openings, no, straight board, all of the external hull openings are shut. And when it's shut, you get this little line, linear. And when all of those lines line up, that means every hull opening is shut. That's straight board. The diving officer of the watch knows as soon as he hears straight board, he can submerge below a certain depth. He wasn't supposed to submerge below a certain depth unless he heard straight board. If for some reason some hatch didn't get shut, he's got to abort the dive and go back up. Otherwise, you're going to get water into the people tank.
Submarine. Yeah. I like that.
You know, and in fact, in my submarine, USS Indianapolis, we had a fish tank in the people tank. But we were the only submarine I knew of that actually had a fish tank in the people tank. So you would abort the dive. But the other thing the crew would do for a crash dive to help get down faster is everybody who wasn't on watch would run to the bow. Because you get all those people weight in the bow, pushing the bow down, and helps get the bow down. It's called a down bubble.
Yeah.
And then you put on more speed, turn the screws, to get to drive down once the screws. Well, what you don't want to have happen is for the screws to broach. Because when the screws broach, you kick up a huge amount of water and it becomes very visible. Now, if you were submerging to conduct a periscope attack, you would submerge only to periscope depth, which was roughly around 60 feet. Let's say 60 feet is measured from, depth is measured from the keel. So when you say 60 feet, you mean from the keel to the top, the depth of the keel.
Mm-hmm. If to the you top are, of the shears, right? To the top of the periscope shears?
No, it's the depth that the keel is. It's at 60 feet.
I gotcha.
Top of the shears is maybe at 15 feet below the surface. It has to be shallow enough for the periscope to come out of the water, right?
Gotcha.
So if however, you're submerging because an airplane was sighted, you want to go deeper than periscope depth because the airplane in clear water can actually see your ship through the hull. And so you want to go down as deep as you, what safe operating depth is, so that the airplanes can't see. So that's the procedure to submerge. And these, again, before the war, you would stay submerged all day. So it didn't matter how long it took you to submerge. Modern nuclear submarines are submerged all the time. There's no reason to surface. We are faster submerged than we are on the surface. So there's no reason at all. So it takes us, we do it very deliberately. It'll take us 5 minutes to submerge a modern nuclear submarine. Mm-hmm. These boats had to practice submerging in a matter of seconds if they didn't want to get blown up.
To your point about aircraft and being sighted from the air, it's very true. You know, if you've ever been, if anybody's ever, I know you have, but if anybody's ever been to an area, an island, clear water, you know, like I just got back from Hawaii, you're going in a couple months. As you're coming in to land, and it's not just Hawaii, it's anywhere where there's blue water, you can see that, you know, the surface, you know, very, very clearly. You can see through that water very clearly. So just because a sub goes down, submerges, doesn't mean that they're safe, you know, from visual detection. And as we'll see in several of these episodes that we're going to talk about, specifically Wahoo, that even though she went down, she wasn't safe, you know, and that's a very important point, because I think a lot of people think, oh, it's under the water, it's clear. No, man, it ain't. You got to go way down there to be visually hidden from any type of aerial surveillance.
Yeah.
And that's most, very, very important.
I used to have the numbers at the tip of my fingers. And I think it's about 50% of the submarines we lost in World War II were lost due to air attack.
I totally believe that. Now,
yeah. The submarines we lost were blue on blue. Mm-hmm. Statistics are not good. There's a lot of that. So yeah, they were more worried about airplanes. Maybe depth charge attacks a close second, but you know, the airplane sneaking up on you is the biggest threat until we had that air search radar. Absolutely. And then it became Absolutely. A manageable threat.
So a lot of these boats later on in the war, not even really later on in 43, they were pressing into the Japanese home islands. They were really getting, I mean, they were doing it in 42 mm-hmm. as well, but more so in 43 and 44. They were getting closer and closer and closer to Japan. And with that, they're doing, you know, they're under the threat of aerial observation and aerial detection a lot more so than when they're out in New Guinea or wherever. Not to say that they couldn't be, but the chances of them being sighted by air out there are a lot less. So you see a lot of these boats that are attacked in 44 and 45, they're mostly attacked by, or at least at the very first part, attacked by aircraft, because that's, you know, and to your point, the whole getting underneath the water as fast as humanly possible, you know, that was drilled in constantly. Well,
absolutely.
Let's talk about getting back on the surface again. Now, we're back on the surface. A lot of the, contrary to popular belief, a lot of submarine kills in World War II in the Pacific were done on the surface. And this includes not just guns, but torpedoes as well. And this is a whole thing. I mean, it's very complicated. Can you walk us through that whole surface attack regimen?
Sure. Yeah. Now, if you're attacking during the day, you would stay on the surface as long as you can, and I'll explain why in a minute. At night, you would stay on the surface generally, if you could, throughout the attack. So in the daytime, the reason you want to stay on the surface, well, you sight a target. Why don't you submerge immediately? The moment you submerge,
you're stopped.
You're restricted to sprints of 8 knots, but generally 2 to 3 knots. Mm-hmm. On the surface, you could position a whole lot better, faster. Because what you got to do once you sight the target is you got to get ahead of the target. Because if you are going to have to submerge because it's a daytime attack, you realize you're not going to be able to move from that point where you submerged very far. So you want to be where you need to be to intercept. Mm-hmm. And in order to get there, the best way to do that is on the surface. Now, keep in mind that a submarine on the surface at very long distances is very hard to see. We would keep the periscope up. So you've got somebody in the conning tower on the scope. So you got this little tiny periscope, maybe 50 feet above the water surface. If you're what's called hull down, which means you're over the horizon from the targets you're sighting, and you're looking for a big surface ship, you're going to be able to see a significant amount of their superstructure. Mm-hmm. And if they look towards you, the only thing that would be visible if they had magnification to see it would be your periscope, because your entire submarine would be hull down. Only that little tiny periscope would be within a field of view. So that gives you a significant advantage. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is you want to determine relative motion. You see a target over the horizon, just a mast initially. Is it moving right or left? If it's moving right, you change course to the right. Moving left, you change course to the left. Sure. Because you want to parallel it and figure out where it's going. Now, the fact that it wasn't there a little while ago and that you see it now indicates that it must be closing you. So the relative motion is towards you, and you need to get to an intercept course. We say this 1,000 times. We used to say it way before Wayne Gretzky started saying it. You don't skate to the puck, you skate to where the puck will be. So we don't maneuver the ship to where the ship, your targets are. You maneuver the ship to where the targets will be. That's called an intercept course. And you want to run fast because you want to stay hull down mm-hmm. while you're doing this sprint, and while you're evaluating the target's course and speed, because you have the height of eye advantage on the scope. Now, there were some disadvantages with the headwind with a periscope. The window at the very top of the periscope is called a head window, particularly when we're operating in the tropical areas. That head window would sometimes fog up. Mm-hmm. And we would have to lower the scope. And in the old days, heck, not in the old days, when I was a junior officer, before Rain-X was invented. We would rub raw potatoes on the head window. We were told that rubbing the raw potato on it would keep it from fogging up. And then we raise the scope again. But you have to worry about that, the head window fogging up. You also, while you're standing off, while you're keeping your distance, try to evaluate the target's zigzag pattern. And you can do this by looking at the mast structure. Are the masts in line? That means it's got a zero angle about. Are they 30 degree angle in the bow like this? Then does it shift? Does the ship pivot like right. that? You could just determine rough kind of force by angle in the bow. And then you time those maneuvers. Are the targets zigzagging or not? Most of the time they did. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they didn't. What you try to do is determine the time of the zigs so you can predict future zigs and factor that into your sprint and intercept course. You get ahead of them. Ideally, what you want to do is get to the point where you need to be at the moment he's going to zig towards.
Right.
That's a lot of inside baseball, Seth, but I think it helps understand why these guys did what they did.
And you know, to that end, setting up an attack, be it on the surface or submerged, sometimes took hours. It almost usually took hours.
Many hours.
And not days. An hour, 8, 10, 12 hours tracking one ship. And sometimes one ship would turn into four. But I mean, that's besides the point. But setting up that attack was not just boom and hey, we're here. It was, I mean, this took a long, long time. Because I mean, the top speed of a Gato class on the surface was what, like 18 knots, 20 knots, something like
knots,
that.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't fast. It was not a fast, but you're not going to outrun
it. Much better.
Oh heck no, you're not going to outrun a destroyer. But
right.
I mean, it took some time to get where they needed to be. So I mean, any miss and you're going to see this in some of these stories, any miscalculation by the approach officer or whatever in his, you know, plot would throw the intercept off by hours, or they would just flat out miss. Like they would not, yeah, they could still see the target. You could never close it. So
you'd never close it. Right. It's so important to get it right at the beginning. You need a range. How do they get the range? Same way I got the range through most of my Navy career. In those days, when you were at periscope depth, you couldn't use the surface search radar to get a range. In my day, we had radar, but we didn't want to use it because electronic surveillance methods, or ESM, was so much better. You did not want to transmit on radar. So we would use passive ranging techniques the same way World War II skippers used. I used them throughout my career. And what you do is you know the height of eye of the target because you understand, you think you've got to figure out what the classification of the target was.
Figure out what the
ship
was.
And even as a junior officer, we would do classification drills, flashcards. Remember those? Flash it up on the screen real quick, 1 second and off. And that's a Krivak class, Russian, Soviet, right? You flash another one. What's that? We would have to look at it for a second and identify it and know the height of the masthead height of that class of ships. They did the same thing in World War II. If it was 1.5 degrees, in low power, you're close. That's a bad thing. 1.5 degrees in high power on the periscope, you know, okay, that's 12,000 yards. You would have to do this math in your head. There was no calculator you could break out. Even when I was an officer on submarines, we would do it in our head because it was just quicker.
Yeah.
It was, you know, we memorized some tables and it was just quicker. Now we would have the computer back it up in my day. And the TDC, torpedo data computer in the conning tower, on World War II class submarines had no way to back it up. So if the skipper or whoever was on the scope got the height of eye wrong or the reticle reading wrong for, you know, how many degrees,
everything
was wrong because the range is now wrong. And if those range is wrong, you're going to get the intercept point wrong. Even if you get a really good course based on angle and bow. And by the way, that's another skill that's really hard to develop. You need a lot of practice to be able to look at that ship, call the angle on the bow, and then, of course, it's easy once you have the angle on the bow to determine what's the course of that ship's course is. But all those things go into the TDC, range, angle on the bow, which determines course, speed, and sometimes you can get speed from turn count from sonar, right? Mm-hmm. Sonar says he's making 75 turns, and that's they're turning
the turns of the screws, right?
Turns of the screw, right? And so you can get some idea of speed by dividing basically turns per knot or TPK. And so all of this math goes in it.
Now makes you my plot, head
hurt. Yeah, made my head hurt for decades. Yeah. Doesn't make my head hurt anymore. I've forgotten all this stuff. But even when you have all of that, we would, even in my day, do mental math. It was called mental math. As they're looking out of the periscope, we had memorized sine tables, cosine tables.
Good Lord.
And then we would multiply the range cosine of angle in the bow to determine the intercept point. So all these things had to be done mentally because you had to do them almost instantaneously in order to check the TDC and make sure that the TDC's solution made sense. Otherwise, you could end up, if you just believe the TDC, the torpedoes go off into no la la land, yeah, and you miss. And that was the worst thing to do.
To that end, you know, you talk about the angle on the bow, and that was an art more than a skill. And, you know, there were guys that trained on figuring that out. And we're going to talk about it. You're going to hear his name repeatedly, not just this episode, but several more. Richard O'Kane. He was probably, arguably, but more than likely, he was a genius. And I say that because of his trigonometric mind, the way he thought, like the things that you just talked about that, you know, made me sweat a little bit. He could do that kind of stuff like that. And he had this eye for calculating the angle on the bow that when he was aboard Wahoo as XO, Mush Morton designed like basically like a training aid that he put, you know, like a little fake ship on, a little model ship on a Lazy Susan. And he would have Dick O'Kane look through a fake periscope and he would twist it so O'Kane could get the angle on the bow. And
he still used different configurations, that same training tool when I was in the Navy.
Developed by Mush Morton. And O'Kane would get it almost every single time within a degree or a half a degree. That's how good this dude was. I mean, he was, and even then, as with somebody with a sharp eye like him and a mind that he had, even he would miss on occasion. So it wasn't and I'm not even talking about the crappy torpedoes. I'm talking about just shooting at a target and missing. So, I mean, it was not an exact science, you know, in World War II. And even guys that were just deadly accurate, like O'Kane, they missed too. You know, so, I mean, it was a constant fight, not just with the Japanese, but with, you know, people say you don't use algebra every day. Well, it depends on what your line of work.
Yeah. Well, Mush knew his own weaknesses. And most of the time, the skipper would be on the scope. And he would have to do this mental math as he's looking out the scope. Mush realized when he was in PCO school in Groton, Connecticut, same PCO school I went to, one or two years later, he realized he wasn't good at that, looking out of the scope and doing all the kinds of things you need to do to figure out how to maneuver the ship. So when he started in PCO school, he realized he could visualize this stuff better if he was not looking out of the scope. So when he became CEO of Wahoo, he told O'Kane, XO, you're going to be on the scope. I'm going to be over here. I'll be conning the ship. But you got to tell me what you see. I need to know what you see. And then I'll drive the ship based on that. It was a wonderful situation. I think they went through three war patrols together like that before O'Kane left to take command of Barb. When I was third officer in USS Buffalo, for whatever reason, my CO decided the same thing, that he wasn't good on the scope. So he put the XO on the scope. They had difficulty communicating. He put me on the scope. Mm-hmm. I'm not the XO, I'm the third officer, I'm department head. And what great training that was for me.
Oh gosh, I later guess so. Yeah.
When I was captain. So I was able to do that when I was department head, when I was XO, and when I was CO. Man, it just came natural to me. Mm-hmm. And I think Dick O'Kane being on the scope as XO on Wahoo really helped him become like the number one World War II CO when he was CO of Tang. So yeah. I really think that helped. Now, when I was CEO, did I put my ex on the scope? Sometimes. Sometimes it depended on what we were doing. Sometimes I would put him on the scope and walk out of the control room to give him the confidence to that he could do
that. He could do things it.
That he could do it. Yeah.
And that's
Mush did a, those kind of same kind of things too during his tenure. You know, he would pretend to go to sleep. I would go in my stateroom sometime and say, "I'm going to go to sleep. You've got it, XO." And then, was I really sleeping? No, we have this speaker in the CEO's stateroom on a fast attack called the White Rat. You know, White Rat, because it's spying on everybody in the control room. You could hear everything they're saying. No, sometimes I was in my stateroom listening to everything that was being said, kind of really tempted to go up back into the control room. And, you know, but I decided I wasn't overcome that urge because I wanted them to gain confidence that they could do it. I would run out there if something happened that I knew they needed me for. But other than that, you know, Mush was a wonderful CEO. He knew what he was good at. He knew what he wasn't good at. And the crew loved him. And really, the results bear his methods out. Now, we'll talk about Mush in a different episode. Because I want to get back to completing this attack because we haven't fired our torpedoes yet, have we, Seth?
No, we haven't. And we'll talk about the defective nature of the torpedoes ad nauseum as we go through these different episodes, but let's just play like the torpedoes work. Let's just assume that they actually go boom when they hit something, or if in the case of magnetic exploders, when they get near something. How would they have done this operation?
Let's assume it's actually not much different whether you're on the surface or submerged, this aspect of it. The only difference is the captain might be on the bridge doing the attack if you're surfaced, and maybe using the device on the bridge specifically that feeds bearings into the TDC, the torpedo data computer. Notice that I said bearings. The radars of those days did not give good bearings. They gave good range, but their bearing inputs sucked. The sonar of those days did not give good bearings. Our sonars today give spectacular bearings. Today, we can conduct a sonar-only approach all day long. Mm-hmm. In those days, if you conducted a sonar-only approach, unless you were very, very close, in which case the bearing accuracy was better, you were going to miss. So the bearing source was always either the Adelaide on the bridge or the periscope if you were submerged. So you would pickle off a bearing mark, and you press a pickle, it's a squeeze ball kind of thing, that your periscope assistant, guy who's circling around with you, would actually do that. And today, the guy on the scope has a button you can press. Bearing mark, range mark, and when you say range mark, it's really, I'm reading the range right now, mark, that second I say range, I'm going to give you the range. It's for the second I say it, because the range changes with time, right?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. And then you give angle and bow. So bearing mark, range mark, angle and bow, port 30. Those inputs go into the TDC. If the TDC says we've got a good firing solution, now you have to decide whether you're going to fire one or salvo. And if you're going to fire a salvo, there's two ways of doing it. The TDC had a knob called the spread knob. You would dial up the spread, which is the difference in bearing between the torpedoes in the salvo. So you can dial a spread of a half a degree between the salvo torpedoes, 1 degree, 2 degrees, whatever you thought necessary. Sure. And that really depended on range. The farther the range was, the tighter the spread may be. But if you have error, range error, or course error, you may want to adjust the spread so it's wider, or you think it's zigzagging, you adjust the spread wider so that regardless of what course they zigzag to, one of the torpedoes is going to hit. Mm-hmm. And when they get the solution ready, they'll say solution ready, which means the TDC says we're going to get a hit based on the solution targets, course, and speed. Then you say set, and then in those days, we would say fire one, fire two, fire three, fire four. When we went to the nuclear Navy and Admiral Rickover was afraid people confuse the word fire one with fire, like there's a fire in the boat.
Right.
We stopped saying fire, and instead we started saying shoot. You can't confuse the word shoot with there's a fire in the galley.
Right.
So back in those days, fire one, fire two, and there was a plunger they would hit in the control room and in the torpedo room at the same time, in case the electrical firing mechanism in the conning tower didn't work, the torpedo men in the torpedo room would hit their local one to fire at the same time. If it fired electrically, they will report. Mm-hmm. One away fired electrically.
Yep.
Okay. You would also report engine swim out, engines running. You would also, sonar would report torpedo running if he heard it. And hopefully the sonarman will tell you the torpedo is running straight, right? Because that's one of the things you're worried about. You're worried about a circular run on the torpedo where the rudder would get stuck on the torpedo after it fired and it would come around. And if it runs in a circle, who's it going to hit?
Mm-hmm. USS Tang.
Right. USS Tang. Yep. And so that's a problem. So you want to know after the torpedoes are firing that they're hot, straight, and normal. Hot means they're firing, that the engine's running straight. What you figure what that means, and normal.
Sure.
Everything
yeah.
sounds right. Okay. So those torpedoes are going to go out towards the ship? No. Towards the intercept point.
Right. To the point where it's going to be.
And so hopefully you start your stopwatch when you fire that first torpedo, because you know from the TDC what the run time is going to be. So when that time is up, 45 seconds or whatever, you should, if you don't hear a boom, you know it's either a miss or it was a dud.
Right.
And both happened, right? Misses awesome. Happened, it was a bad solution. And duds happen actually for two reasons. So when we did impact fusing, it could hit the side of the ship and just basically sink to the bottom because the fuse didn't work. The detonator didn't work. If it was influence fused, which means it runs under the ship and explodes, it could not explode for two reasons. Either the influence detonator didn't work properly, or the torpedo ran too deep and never sensed the magnetic influence of the ship above it. And so wouldn't detonate because it didn't sense. And that would happen if the torpedoes erroneously ran at the wrong depth. And both of those things happen. We'll talk about that in future episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a common, all too common occurrence for those things to, it's a crime. And when you look at the Pacific War and things, bad things that happened to U.S. forces, and it was not solely U.S. forces that had bad torpedoes, but we've certainly had the worst. It's an absolute tragedy.
Especially compared to the Japanese.
Yeah. Hell, even the Brits. I mean, you know, the Brits, right. The Italians, Germans, for crying out loud. You know, I mean, their torpedoes didn't always work, but they worked about 95% mm-hmm. of the time. Ours were probably less than 50 in certain aspects of the war, certain time periods. Well, you know,
one thing I want to say, though, before we get off this too much, is there's also a decision that needs to be made before you fire. And that decision, let's say you're shooting at periscope depth. This is still true today. When you want to expose the minimum amount of periscope possible to reduce the probability that your periscope will be seen. And if the seas are glassy, which is, they believe it or not, even in open ocean, sometimes you have glassy seas. We adjust the depth of the ship to control the amount of scope that's sticking out of the water. You don't raise and lower the scope from its fully raised position like you see sometimes in movies, because when the scope's fully raised, it sits in an upper bearing that keeps the scope from vibrating. And if you lower it even a foot, it's not in that upper bearing anymore, and it vibrates and the world shakes. You can't see anything. Right. So you always keep the scope fully raised, and you control ship depth to control how much scope is exposed. My crews were so good that I could keep the scope half out of the water. In other words, the water line was halfway up the head window. Mm. That requires a lot of precision. The World War II crews could do that too. But if you expose too much scope, or you're going too fast, and the and the scope left what was called a rooster tail in the water, stream of water shooting up behind the scope.
You're going to see that.
You would be detected. But before you fire, one of the decisions you have to make is, am I going to stay at PD after time of fire, or am I going to go deep? And by the way, amateurs say they submerged. No, you've been submerged the whole time if you're at periscope depth. You go deep when you leave periscope depth and go deep. You don't, you're not submerging, you're going deep. Okay, so that's one of the decisions you have to make. If you're worried that once a ship blows up, there are destroyers out there that are going to be looking for you, you may decide to go deep. Mm-hmm. If you position yourself relative to the screen, and we'll talk about that in a moment, in such a way that you know you're going to have time, that it's going to take a while for the screen, the destroyers, to react to the boom, then you may make the decision to stay PD for two reasons. Number one, to confirm that you actually got a hit, because sometimes torpedoes exploded prematurely. And number two, to figure out who you're going to shoot next.
Right.
And sometimes you had more bow tubes with torpedoes loaded, or you could turn and use the stern tubes and shoot somebody else. So those decisions all went into the calculus, and you decided all of that stuff, and you announced your intentions to people in the conning tower before you shot, so that everybody knew what to expect. Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated matter. It's a complicated series of events that I think, you know, we wanted people to get to grasp the knowledge, and you know, submarines are a little more intricate than a lot of people, well, a lot more intricate than people think. And I think that by going through these individual steps like this, I hope, and I know you feel the same, that it would give people a little more appreciation to the events and the actions and the adventures, really, that some of these skippers mm-hmm. were able to pull off, you know, because I mean, some of these things are bizarre. I mean, you hear, you know, Eugene Flucky, we'll talk about him, you know, in another episode. I mean, some of the things he did, it's like
putting a rocket on the submarine.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird, but it's true, and it's, you know, it's really, 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 really cool. So, yeah. You know, we wanted people to understand that it's not just like the John Wayne movies. I mean, the John Wayne movies got some inspiration from the real events, but there's a heck of a lot more that went into it than just dive, pull the trigger, and boom, you know, it just doesn't work mm-hmm. like that. Well, Bill,
now, sadly, from a movie standpoint, the one that gets it the best isn't an American movie, it's Das Boot, the German movie. And then they use German techniques, not American Pacific techniques. The movie that gets it right for the American Pacific World War II theater has not yet been made. The only thoughts I would leave with you in closing, because I think we've talked about this long enough, Seth, are, you know, what do you do in a convoy situation? Who do you shoot first, the biggest target or the biggest threat? Mm-hmm. If you shoot the biggest threat, maybe, and it's a night surface attack, maybe you can stay with them long enough to get the biggest target, and maybe that gives you more advantages if the threat is removed from you. But generally, no, you shoot the biggest target, right? Because once the first ship goes boom, everybody skedaddles.
Everybody and becomes knows.
Nothing's guaranteed after that. So 90% of the time, they're going to shoot the biggest target, or multiple targets at the same time, rather than worrying about a zigzag and shoot a salvo at one target. You can shoot a spread into a concentration of targets, knowing that something is going to hit somebody.
Hit something. Yep.
And that was done. The other bit I would tell you, a little bit of it, you know, maybe more information than folks need, but our listeners seem to like the detail, don't they?
They do. That's why we're doing this.
Is that Mush never used the spread knob on the TDC to fire a salvo. Mush always picked a point on the ship. The other thing to think about is, what do you do in response to a depth charge attack? Mm-hmm. The deeper you are, maybe the better it is, but the deeper you are, the more effective the concussion is,
right,
of the depth charge, and the closer you are to your design tolerances for pressure and overpressure, and the more dangerous it is to the submarine. So there's calculus that goes into there. The shallower you are during a depth charge attack, the farther you away from those pipes going burst because the pressure is lower. Of course, this calculus was made worse by a certain congressman, May of Kentucky.
Kentucky.
Yeah. We've talked about him before, came back from a Pacific tour and bragged to a reporter and published in the Chicago Sun that those stupid Japanese are setting their depth charges too shallow. And Admiral Lockwood estimated that Congressman May's stupid statement cost the lives of 800 submarine sailors. And the other thing, of course, we've said this multiple times, but I'll say it one more time in this episode for completeness, in case this is the only one you listen to. The death rate, the fatality rate for submariners was the highest in the military during World War II, higher even than daylight bombing raids over Europe. And so on average, you know, submariners knew that there was a, you know, I think we lost 25% of our submarines, 52 total.
52 boats.
Yeah. And, you know, so people knew that, and it was all volunteer, so people did have to volunteer for it. We'll talk about how Dudley dealt with that in a different episode, how Mush dealt with it. But, you know, people knew that they were going out and there was a reasonable chance that they weren't coming back. So these men, and they were all men, of course, were great, great heroes. And with that, hand it back to you, Seth.
Well, you know, before I read our canned final statement, I will add to what you said that, you know, yes, they were all volunteers. And yes, 52 boats were lost during World War II. There were other guys that were killed, you know, on different patrols too. But, you know, when people think of the elite of the U.S. Navy, one naturally tends to gravitate towards guys with wings of gold on their chest. And of course, I'm referring to naval aviators, which of course, in their own right, were and are very elite. I still say to this day that naval aviators were and are the finest people flying an airplane in the entire world. However, another elite service of the United States Navy in World War II, then and now, is the silent surf, or was and is the silent service, because as you said, you know, these guys are volunteers, and if somebody screws up, that generally often means that nobody comes home. And you really can't say that with a lot of other services in the United States, or a lot of other branches in the United States Navy. It's one guy screws it up, it screws it up for everybody. And that's not necessarily the case on a battleship or, you know, what have you. And it's important to note that. And you'll hear some of these stories as we go on through the rest of this season. So with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on this little tidbit and Submarines 101 by our very own submarine skipper, Captain Bill Toady. We want to thank you for listening, and we hope you did enjoy this very, very intriguing and exciting portion of World War II Pacific submarine history. Now, please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, as always, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast. We do see that a lot of people, most people do watch us on YouTube, and you know, we thank you for that. If you're not subscribing to our YouTube channel, please do. It helps us out, and by that I mean it helps other people find our show too. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, thank you for watching. My name is Seth Paradin, and I want to say thank you again. And Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. I hope this proved worthy for you, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Yep, and we will see you next week.